Accession 27807, Mr. Harry Hooper, Reel 4. Now, we were talking about, you know, preparing for the kit inspections.
Yeah.
And then we sort of moved from there into moving into almost a typical day. So what would a typical day's training be like?
Well, get up, make the bed, go on parade. 7 o'clock till 7:20. At the end of parade, we were inspected. At the end of parade, we go in and get breakfast. Then we go back to our rooms.
Was the food any better?
Food was much better. It was edible. After breakfast, we go back to our rooms, collect all our books and stuff we'd need for lectures that day, and we would march as a flight to the lecture rooms. As we got into the winter, of course, it was dark very early in Scotland, and we would have a white hurricane lamp at the front of the flight and a red hurricane at the back, just like a vehicle. Marching through the streets of St. Andrews, no one up. And we would go into lectures, and we had half an hour break for lunch. We worked in the afternoons till 5 or 6, I think. Got through a lot of work, and then we went back, we had tea, and then we did study. We studied, I mean, quite a bit. You know, we went through it all, wrote notes, and we started cleaning for the next day. We cleaned our gear and that, and if we were on guard duty, we reported down for guard duty. That only came around about once every 4 or 5 days, guard duty.
Was there any question of you being allowed out into...
Well, there wasn't at first, and then it's strange. Our room, each Saturday, a room would be designated as the best room in the flight, in the hotel, from the inspections of the room. And it's strange to say that my room won it every time. But that meant you got a late pass till 10 on Saturday night. Saturday night from 6 to 10, you got a late pass and free going to drink. And that I didn't drink, so it didn't bother me. The little chap, one of the chaps, this little German chap, he was the sort of guy that cleaned the room. To let you know his mindset, this room was a small room with one white porcelain basin. And the water, hot and cold water coming into the basin, came down through the ceiling to 2 3-quarter-inch pipes. They'd been painted over through the years with whitewash or white paint so that they were white. He scraped the paint off these, so he got back to the copper, and he polished those copper pipes every day. No one else did this, he did it. And he cleaned the windows every day. He polished the doorknob every day. So we had, you know, we didn't have to do anything in the room. This little chap did it all, and we won. But neither he or I ever took advantage of these late passes. And of course, we were not exactly alike, because we won, he won everything for smartness and cleanliness and polishing in the room. So I did nothing, really, but I didn't take advantage at all.
You didn't drink at all?
No, I didn't drink.
You shouldn't have done at that age.
I didn't drink. No, I didn't drink. Now I spent any spare time I had, I swatted. I liked it so much, you see. It wasn't sort of a chore at all. I loved it. I'd get into that literary. Oh, that's marvellous. And I was always reading ahead. We had big class notes. I've got them somewhere in the study. You know, that you went through the course. And I was always reading ahead. So when the guy lectured us, I knew it. But I found it pleasant. Others, I think, found it more difficult. And, you know, they'd been free and they were older than I, and they challenged authority. I didn't. I loved it.
Now, you were there, basically till December, I think.
That's right. Now, by that time, the RAF had found that when they sent pupils to start flying, they would get pupils into the flying schools, and at elementary school they'd do a number of hours but really weren't good enough, and they would be washed out. The guys just were not suitable. Some of them went on to service flying training school and more advanced aircraft, and again the same thing would happen. So the RAF decided to put in what they called grading schools. These were the former Well, they were elementary flying training schools that existed in the UK at the present time on Magisters mainly and Tiger Moths. And when you finished ITW, you were sent to one of these schools and you were told you did 12 hours flying on the particular aircraft that they used. In my case, I went to Scone, just north of Perth. And Scone. You heard of the Stone of Scone? That's the thing the Royal King sat on. S-C-O-N-E. Yes, Scone. Yeah, I call it Scone because the Scots did up there. Scone was a small airfield operated by one of the large training centres, pre-war centres down in the south. They were at Heston and they operated Scone, teaching civilians. But they were now turned over to the RAF, and the RAF instructors there did 12 hours on this grading course. At the end of that, they graded you whether you could go on for pilot training or be reassessed and sent for bomb aimer or navigator training, which had those two trades come in to replace the old original observer by then.
So the purpose of the grading course was to
eliminate those which were the RAF deemed at the time were not suitable to go on further training because it was a waste of money and time. They wanted to, they got more efficient, as it were.
Now, what happened when you first got to Scone?
Scone, we were introduced to the DH-82A. And
Which is that?
That's the Tiger Moth.
Yeah.
And we were allocated an instructor. We were four pupils to an instructor.
Now, this is before you've done even the initial, your first flight.
Do
you remember who your instructor was?
Yes, I do know there. Sergeant Morgan, newly appointed flying instructor. Now we were his first pupils.
What did you think of your flying, meeting with him?
He was a super chap. Quiet, good looking, 5'10", well built, handsome. He looked the part. And he talked the part. He was confident, secure. Although we were his first pupils, you'd have thought he was an old timer and knew everything.
And he seemed to have a grasp of it.
Yeah, he was good. This guy was good, in my opinion. My humble opinion at the time. But then, of course, it was winter, and the ground was frozen solid, and there were ruts everywhere. And when aircraft were kept on losing their little We didn't have tail wheels. We had tail skids. And they were breaking off in the rutted stuff. But what I did there, unusually, I was the only person to solo. They didn't normally expect you to solo. They just wanted to grade you.
Tell me about your first flights.
Well, the first flight was a familiarization flight. So that was the first time I'd been in an airplane, first time I'd lifted off the ground.
I
was quite scared at first because this was a fragile-looking aircraft. And we sat in the front seat, he sat in the back seat for this, and he sort of gunned the motor, and the noise and the vibration sort of shook me. I hadn't realised, going across a grass airfield, the aircraft was shaking, the tail came up, and suddenly we were off, and we were flying. And he climbed away, and he started pointing out various landmarks. And at Scone, you could fly to the Tay Estuary. So it was a great landmark, this great estuary coming in on the River Tay. And the Tay Bridge, the old original road, not the road bridge, the rail bridge at the time. And he flew around. You got that on every airfield you joined, familiarization with the local scenery. And you went back. And from then on, you started doing circuits and bumps.
And did you like it as much?
I loved it. It was terribly cold. There's no heating these aircraft. And this was winter in Scotland.
And so you did the flights with Morgan as pilot, as opposed to your solo, were from the 1st to the 10th of January 1943.
Yes.
So very cold.
Bitterly cold. We had our flying gear then was, what we had was silk underwear, long johns and a long sleeve vest made of silk. Now, I never wore those.
Why not?
I don't know why. I just never wore. I didn't. The idea of a long john or long sleeve vest didn't appeal. I never wore them. But we wore our uniform, which was a battle dress tunic then. We wore this we put then on a quilted inner. This was a brown quilted, you know, stitched like a quilt in diamond shapes, and it was K-pop filled. It was thick and bulky, made you look like Michelin Man. And it zipped up at the legs and the sleeves and up the front. And over that you put the original old Sidcot suit, which was a heavy canvas flying suit, outer, with zipped legs, pockets, zip sleeves, cuffs, zip front, and a big heavy collar, a leather flying helmet, and flying goggles attached. Now, I must go back because I've forgotten something. Whilst I was at St. Andrews, initial training wing, towards the end of the course, I was told I had to go down to London, to Abbey Lodge, to collect my flying goggles. So I went overnight. I stood up all night on the train on a Friday night, got down into King's Cross after about 15 hours or so on the train. I got the underground. I went, reported to Abbey Lodge and waited around for a bit. It was a Saturday morning. I hadn't had any sleep. And I thought, I'm bound to fail, I'm bound to fail. What happened was I was handed a square box, well, two square boxes, each containing a set of RAF flying goggles, which then were the angular type. They had a flat front and a flat corner piece. And I wore those and did an eye test for about 2 hours, various tests, wearing the goggles. And they passed okay. It was fine. If I wore the goggles, I could see, apparently. And if I didn't, I couldn't. And I then got the train back Saturday night, so I was back Sunday morning. And I'd got flying goggles. And I wore them. You had them attached through a strap on the helmet on the top. And, of course, on the Tiger Moth, it being an open cockpit, you put them down to fly with.
Now, take me through. I mean, you've got these flights totaling eight hours, 40 minutes with Morgan, Sergeant Morgan, in the Tiger Moth from January 1st to 10th. Now, how did he take you through? I mean, you're right. You shouldn't have gone solo by normal means.
They didn't expect it. There wasn't in the curriculum. It was just 12 hours. The thing was to grade you, not can you fly. Are you good enough to go on?
So what did Morgan take you through? I mean, the first flight is just familiarisation.
Yes.
Then what does he do then? So
well, the next thing he did, we did circuits and bumps.
Now, can you explain what
I did? Yes, circuits and bumps. You line the aircraft up. You open the throttle. You proceed across the airfield, hopefully, and you take off. You rise to a certain height. You make a circuit of the airfield and come in and land into wind. Now, this was a grass field, so you flew into wind direction. You landed according to the windsock. At the end, by the windsock, at the end, there would be a guy standing around in a little hut. He had a red and green Aldis lamp, and he would give you a green on the approach that you were okay to go. If he gave you a red, you opened up and went round again because someone else was still on the landing path or coming in underneath you or something.
Now, how much of this circuiting and bumping would Morgan do and how much of it would you do? I
mean, well, he did the first one and he said, now you have a shot.
Oh, second go.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no point, is there, really? And he said, during the first one, or he may have done two, I think it was only one, he said, you put your feet on the rudder bars and hands on the stick, but very lightly, but follow me through.
So you could feel what he was doing?
Yeah, I never felt nervous with him. He was tremendous. And I took off, I thought, with him, and I thought, well, this is fairly easy. Then we went round and
about
landed.
Turning? I mean, well, that had you learned the theory of what to do?
Well, of course, we had drilled in, there was a thing called needle ball airspeed. We had a very elementary flight panel. We had a turn and bank indicator, which one needle at the bottom showed you, at the top rather, showed you the rate, the turn you were doing. The rate of turn, 1 to 4. 1 would be a gentle turn, 2 would be a slightly 30 degree bank, 60, and a rate 4 turn was virtually a vertical turn, you know, the aircraft around, you had to put a lot of power. Of course, during this, he taught us, or taught me, that when you turn, you lose lift. And to turn the aircraft, in those sort of aircraft, you had to apply aileron at first to get the left wing down if you were turning left and the right wing up. But that would introduce a skidding pitch. So you gently applied enough rudder one way or the other to stop the skidding. You'd found out whether you were skidding or not, A, by the wind on your cheek, or B, by the turn and bank indicator. One needle showed you how much bank you've got on. The other needle, if it pointed in the middle, meant that you weren't slipping or skidding. You weren't slipping in or skidding out. And you so needle, you got that. Another instrument was the ball. This had a ball in a curved glass vessel. Well, it was a slightly a banana shape. And that ball, if you skidded or slid, would move left or right. So that was the other instrument. And of course, airspeed was the most important thing of all. So you needle, ball, airspeed.
So you knew about stalling then?
Yes, theory of flight. We'd done all this, you know, stalling, the aircraft stalling and that sort of thing. And during that first flight with the Morgan, when he, apart from showing us the landmarks, he would demonstrate a stall. This is what a stall feels like. You know, pull the nose up and shudder and down it would go. And but we never did spinning because this was a grading course. You weren't really learning to fly. You were doing what they wanted you to do. And they watched what you were doing, how you did it.
So the stall demonstration, you just stalled it to show
yeah,
you.
Yeah, show you. Got yeah, this up. Is a sort of, I think it was one of those things you just had to do it.
So first, he takes you around a circuit bump
yeah.
with you feeling the control.
Yes.
And then you do it. Any difficult?
Well, when I did it, he said, now you have a shot. Well, first, of course, you've got to get to where you're going to take off from. Bearing in mind, the Tiger Wolf hadn't got a tail wheel, it got a skid. Got no brakes. So the only way you can proceed forward is by opening the throttle. The only one way you can move left or right is putting rudder on and give it a big burst of throttle so that the rudder moves the tail round. This tail skid revolves around a centre pivot. On grass, you do come to a stop fairly quickly. You know, brakes weren't probably paramount. But it was quite an art because when you taxied, you couldn't see in front because the nose of the aircraft was high. So you learnt to taxi. You veered left, veered right. And so you proceeded in a crabwise situation until you got to the near the takeoff point where you stopped and pointed the aircraft into wind. And then you ran up the engine with holding the stick back so that the tail didn't lift off. And you checked for mag drop. You checked the magnetos. There are two magnetos to all those aircraft engines. You check one, and if it dropped more than 50 revs, you had a problem. And then you check the number two mag, and if that didn't drop more than 50, you were fine. You went back on two. And then you waited, you got a green. You were in wind, you open up the throttle. And as soon as you open the throttle, the aircraft wants to turn. So you combat that with opposite rudder. And then you gradually ease, you can feel the tail wanting to lift, and you ease the stick forwards very slightly till you've got the tail up. And then you go across the air, bump across the airfield till you reach flying speed. As I recall, it was 70 or 75 for the Tiger Moth. And it just lifted off, wafted off. And immediately, if it was nearly always fairly bumpy, the aircraft started going up and down and left and bumping. And you trying to keep level was difficult. And you climbed, a typical RAF circuit was you climbed up to 500 to 600 feet, straight ahead. Then when you got to that height, you did a left turn, this is a right angle, a 90 degree turn, still climbing, till you got to 1,000 feet, whereupon you leveled out. You turned through another 90 degrees so that you were heading downwind parallel to the landing path. When you saw the end of the landing path, the beginning of it, by the wingtip, you turned a crosswind and you eased the throttle off and began to lose height. You went across wind until you were sure that if you could turn onto the landing path or runway. And at that juncture, you made sure that you had sufficient airspeed and you approached in a glide with the engine throttled back on the Tiger Moth, or we did, so that you arrived over the boundary to round out and then hold off until you did a perfect three-pointer. I say that with a smile.
What was your first circuit?
I don't know, really. I can't recall exactly. I didn't have all that much... Well, I didn't have many problems. I just carried on. We did these circuits and bounced. Then he took me away. So I'll show you some aerobatics, which frightened me a bit. And then we came back, and one day...
What aerobatics did he show you?
We did a loop and a roll.
Now, did he do it?
Oh, no, he did it.
He
just showed me, yeah.
And what did you think of rolling loops, that sort of thing?
Well, I know that the loop wasn't so bad, but in a roll, especially in a Tiger Moth, upside down, you went into the shoulder straps. If your straps weren't tight, you left your seat. And everything, the cockpit floor is covered in mud, dirt, nuts, bolts, and everything falls down on you, unless it's a perfect roll. It's difficult in a Tiger Moth, so bits and pieces shower down. You're glad you've got, goggles on. But and hanging in the straps was a bit frightening at first, but with an instructor, you feel safe. I did some more circuits and landing, and then one afternoon, I landed. He said, go back to the start. So I meandered, taxied back to the start. I stopped, expecting him to, say, wait till we get a green. And suddenly I found he was getting out of the aircraft. And he got out of the aircraft and he did his strap, the seat straps up in the back or in the front, I forget, but I was probably in the front of the aircraft. And he said, well, off you go. I said, huh? He said, go on, off you go, like that. He said, oh, by the way, don't you forget to come back and pick me up or I'll give you, and that frightened the life out of me. And all I thought about was not taking off for the first time in my life was, don't forget to pick Sergeant Morgan up. He took your mind straight away out of worrying and then bonk, straight off, rounded the circuit, came back. He said, well, that was all right, wasn't it? And I said, yeah, fine.
So you had barely any time to worry. Because first solo flight, most people worry about it.
Well, I suppose I don't think they do today because the aircraft are completely different, and they're
but
solid.
Then, but I mean...
Yeah, it was. I didn't... I think people would worry, but all I know is that he had the ability to make you stop worrying. I never really worried with that guy. He was perfect.
And you'd only done 8 hours, 40 minutes.
Well, some people
minutes.
Soloed after 5 in some place, I believe. But 8 to 10 hours would be normal.
But that was a 15-minute flight on the 10th of January, 1943.
Yes.
And he let you fly a couple more times.
Yes, he did, because just before the end, he said, come on, you can go. We'll go out. And he did a check circuit. He said, you do 2 or 3 circuits. And I did. And I was the only one on the course that did it. So that meant I thought, well, I'm Superman now. I'm super pilot. None of the others have soloed. I'm the only one. I must be tremendous. I wasn't, but, that's how I felt.
Now, was there anything else? I mean, that's what was going on in the air. When you're not there long, it's only a grading course.
Yes.
You're there, basically. You go there in December, and you're there about a month.
That's right.
Now, anything else happen? Any other part of the training going on? Or was it just really just that? Just the
well,
air?
The other thing we did there were guards. We patrolled the airfield at night for very long periods with a rifle in case the Germans came. I didn't. But we did guards at night. That was a bind. But other than that, no fun. I will say this. I had my first drink whilst I was at Perth. A man called Hudson, a great big hulking Yorkshireman, and someone else I can't remember, said, come on, let's go into Perth. And we went in on the Saturday evening to Perth. We weren't on guards. And we went into the Salutation Arms, which was a hotel, and had a bar, small like cocktail type bar. And we went to the bar, and they ordered whiskey or scotch each. And they said, what are you having? And I said, oh, I'll have the same as you. So my first drink was a scotch with water. I didn't like it, but I drank it, obviously. I show that I couldn't drink. And we spent a couple of hours there and then went back. I went into Perth another Saturday, and in the afternoon with a colleague, and we went to, there was a cinema there, and they had a restaurant, a sort of above the foyer. And we went out there and managed to get poached eggs on toast in the middle of the afternoon. Scotland was hardly, well, the rural parts of Scotland were never short of food. And Perth was, you know, a county town. It was a lovely town, and they didn't know there was a war on, as far as I was concerned.
Now, anything else about your time there?
Not really.
Now, there seems to be a gap then, because
there's
January, and then so your next course...
Transport?
Is in April 12th it starts.
Where's that? Hull Havington? No.
You go to 17 Elementary Flying Training School at Stanley, Nova Scotia.
Ah, well.
You're on the way. I hadn't read the Nova Scotia bit.
Well, before I get to Nova Scotia...
I haven't got anything else in here.
Oh, you haven't got it in there, but you've got it there, I think.
Right. So what happens next then?
Well, from there, we were posted to Heaton Park, Manchester. And that was a holding centre to be sent to one of the sort of Commonwealth Air Training Plan areas for further training. We waited around there quite a while.
Were you doing anything? That's Heaton Park, Manchester, isn't it?
We did a few lectures there, but by and large, we were in Nissen huts, which had been put up in the park. And by and large, we had a lot of time to ourselves. And there I did a bit of drinking. I think I talked to the odd girl there in bars and that, but that's about all. I also got a posting from there, I think, to...
St. Athan.
Yeah. Now, because we were hanging around, some of us were sent to Athens, which was the RAF sort of engineering centre, and in South Wales, and we did an engine handling course there. There we learnt, you know, things about advanced aircraft engines, the Hercules, the Rolls-Royce, Merlin, and other aircraft.
Now,
we
when
saw
you say
them
handling, what do you mean? Do you mean...
No, we didn't start, didn't fly.
Maintenance, or do you mean...
Really, how to handle the mixture, how the mixture you either rich or enrich the aircraft mixture or weaken it with height, how it falls off with height. We learnt about the automatic mixture control, supercharging, two-stage supercharging, all theory, but we had engines, you know, in the sort of engineering section there, which had been sectioned, so you could see things move up and down. They moved them by electric motors. And I think there I really began to appreciate aircraft engines. I liked them, and I knew quite a bit. I was very interested in it, and I got into it, and I knew a lot about engines, in theory anyway. I've never handled one.
And this is 45 OTT, standing for OTT would be?
OTT. Officers Training. Where was that at?
At St. Athan.
Oh.
Difficult to know what it is.
Oh, no, that's the... I think it's something technical training. Officers Technical Training, I think it stands for.